With the BBC News at 3 o'clock, this is Jason Kay. The experimental antiviral drug remdesivir has been approved for use by US regulators as an emergency treatment for COVID-19. Early trials have suggested it could reduce the duration of symptoms in some patients from 15 to 11 days. Barbara Plaitusher reports from Washington.
President Trump has been a vocal supporter of remdesivir as a possible way to bring the coronavirus pandemic under control. He made the announcement in the Oval Office, alongside the head of Gilead Sciences, which makes the antiviral drug. The company has said there's data to show it helps improve outcomes for patients with COVID-19, especially if given early in the course of infection. Other experts have warned that remdesivir doesn't represent a magic bullet in treating the disease.
Labour has raised questions about the government's claim that it has reached its target of achieving 100,000 coronavirus tests a day by the end of April. The Health Secretary Matt Hancock said more than 122,000 tests have been carried out on Thursday. Labour says the figure includes 39,000 tests that were posted to people's homes but not yet returned. The Irish Prime Minister Leo Varadkar has announced plans for reopening the country's economy. He said the first of five phases would begin on the 18th of May, when small social gatherings would be permitted outdoors. If the virus is kept under control, the final stage will go ahead in August. But he warned the risk of a second wave of the virus was ever present.
In any scenario, at least until we have a vaccine or an effective treatment, there will be a long-term need for physical distancing, good hand hygiene, respiratory hygiene, regular cleaning, and for people to stay at home and isolate if they're sick.
Space fans are being urged not to travel to Florida for the first launch of astronauts from American soil in nearly a decade. In the past, huge crowds have descended on the Kennedy Space Center, but NASA said people should watch the event later this month at home because of the coronavirus outbreak. One of the astronauts, Douglas G. Hurley, agreed with that advice.
Yeah, it certainly is disappointing. Aspect of all this pandemic is the fact that we won't have, you know, the luxury of our family and friends being there at Kennedy to watch the launch. But it's obviously the right thing to do in the current environment.
Some waste and recycling centres in England are to reopen this morning as part of an attempt to deal with an increase in fly tipping since the lockdown began. Some are restricting the types of waste that they'll handle or the number of cars allowed in. Tips in Scotland remain closed. In Wales and Northern Ireland, planning for reopening is underway. And the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has appeared in public for the first time in nearly 3 weeks, ending an absence that prompted international rumours about his health. The country's official news agency released pictures showing him opening a fertilizer plant near the capital, Pyongyang, and laughing alongside officials. And that's your BBC News for now. It's 3 minutes past three.
Walking silent through the snow, drifting softly to your door, I'm coming home, I'm coming home. I feel so strange, I feel so weak, I've walked a world of empty streets in search alone. I've searched alone, but you're still in my mind, you're still in my mind, and here's where the sound of my tears hits the ground, just like the rain, just like the rain. When we walk along the shore, my darkness shaded all we saw. I was unkind, I was unkind. I feel so strange, I feel so weak, I've walked a world of empty streets in search alone. I've searched alone, but you're still in my mind, still in my mind. And here's where the sound of my tears hits the ground, just like the rain, just like the rain. Still in my mind, and here's where the sound of my tears hits the ground, just like the rain, just like the rain, just like the rain, just like the rain.
I'm Matt Everett, and welcome to The First Time, where we look at the pivotal first moments that made some of our most influential musicians who they are today.
Darling, do you remember me? Back when I used to be your darling.
I first met Richard Hawley about 10 years ago, before a gig where he was showcasing his first EP. I knew he was from Sheffield, I knew he used to be in the Long Pigs, I knew he used to play guitar with Pulp from time to time, but until I heard him play, I didn't realise what a fantastic songwriter he was. He follows, I believe, a tradition of classic broken-hearted balladeers, people like Roy Orbison, Lee Hazlewood, Hank Williams, even Elvis. That first chat, which took place over several pints of Guinness, was the first of many interviews and many pints that I've enjoyed with him since. So it was a pleasure to speak to him for this show. And as always, I started off by asking him when he was first aware of music.
My dad had like a massive record collection. It was like 6,000 albums, and as well as being a musician and a steelworker. And just music would be on all the time, you know, pretty much. I learned to sing with my mum when she used to do the ironing, and she used to put on an album called Gone 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 by the Everly Brothers, and she'd sing the harmony part, and when the record had finished, she'd kind of just hum to herself singing the harmony part, and she taught me to sing the lead lines, because my dad wasn't there, and she spent a lot of time with me teaching me to sing, you know. And my grandfather as well, he was a music hall performer, and he used to play the musical saw and a violin as well, and he used to stand on his head and play the violin behind the back of his neck. That was the music hall act. Obviously it wasn't very successful, but I must say that playing the violin behind his head predated Hendrix by some 20 years, you know. But yeah, it was just around, you know, all the time.
What was the first single that you owned?
There used to be, like, in Firth Park, there used to be an ironmonger's shop called Hood Arts, and they used to, as well as selling hammers and nails and shovels and paraffin and all that, is that they also used to have a little stand with pop jukebox X-singles, pop X-singles. And I remember buying a record with my dad in Kenny's Records, and it was a 78 Race with the Devil, Gene Vincent, but I think he kind of wanted me to buy that, you know what I mean? But the first record I ever chose to buy was Kid by the Pretenders. I remember I was probably about 9 or 10. I remember that. That was a Pop X single in Hood Arts. My sister still has them all, and I still keep trying to nick them back off her.
Never outgrow. You think it's wrong.
Did you... It kind of equates the music that you were loving with something that you wanted to do yourself? Or did it seem quite kind of unobtainable to be performing?
I sort of started playing guitar when I was six or seven years old. It was kind of to fit into what the family was doing, you know, because we always played music together. But it didn't occur to me that that's what I wanted to do with my life until I went to secondary school. And the bullshit that careers advisors and this, that and the other gave you, I just thought, what a horrible life that's going to be if I follow that path. And the answers seemed to be fairly simple for me. I was very lucky because, you know, when you're that age, I mean, I've got a 16-year-old daughter who doesn't know really what she wants to do. And that word, what you want to be, is that was already formulated for me, in a way. Do you understand what I mean? It was already kind of there. And it was just fairly obvious. I suppose, to be honest, is I ended up becoming a musician because I couldn't really think of anything else to do that inspired me with any passion, you know. And my grandfather used to say to me, if you choose a job you love, son, you'll never work a day in your life. It's an old cliche, and it's not actually true, but there is a degree of truth in that for what I found, you know, because it's hard work being a musician. You know, there's that old joke, what is the difference between a guitar player and a deep pan pizza? Deep pan pizza can feed a family of four, you know. You know, and it's not easy being a musician, but also my family were steelworkers as well, so my dad and my granddad used to work 14 hours a day in Firth Brown Steelworks, and that's always at the back of my mind if ever I start pissing and moaning about, oh God, I'm really knackered, and you know, it's quite easy to just remind yourself you could be doing that, mate.
Can you remember writing your first song?
I do, yeah.
What was it called and what was it like?
I don't remember the title. I remember the chords and the melody, but I can't remember the words. They were probably not very good. But I remember my dad, I was about nine, I think, and it was very late at night, I don't know what time, but my dad came upstairs just to check that me and my sisters were asleep, I presume, you know. And he came in the bedroom and my light was still on, and he was like, what are you doing awake? And he was quite cross with me. And I said, I can't figure out whose tune this is. I don't know whose it is. And he said, play it me. He was quite cross. And I played it him, and he said, it's yours. And just turned the light off, and I go to bed. And that was something, to lay there in the dark thinking, it's mine. Wow. I can make my own music up. That was quite a revelation, really, you know.
What did it sound like? What kind of music were you listening to at that age that might have influenced it?
It probably sounded like an old Ricky Nelson song or something, you know. I don't think things have changed much for me. But, you know...
Get a plan, stick to it.
That's it, yeah. And, just to kind of find out that you could make something up that belonged to you and that you could write yourself was pretty amazing revelation, really. And since that day till now, they've still kept popping in my head, you know.
What was your first gig like? Because you toured quite early, didn't you? Quite young.
My first gig, I mean, I played in little pubs and stuff, you know, with my dad. My dad used to run like a folk club is too grand a word for it, really. It was just a back room in St. Cuthbert's Club on Barnsley Road. And there'd be just local people who owned guitars. Some of them weren't even what you would call a musician, you know. But they all had a pop and a play. And I'd get my little spot where I'd just sing what I knew. I used to do a song called Jenny. I'm begging tonight for my Jenny, who has gone far away now from me. And it was this old thingy, Ken Cook, he was called. And it was on Sun Records. And I loved the song when I was a kid. And that was my little spot, you know. And they'd all tolerate this snotty-nosed little kid who'd sing this song. But I learned a lot from those men. A lot. They had hard lives, you know. But they were very gentle people. And they were into music and into... they talk incessantly about music, and it was great, you know, sit in a back room with loads of steelworkers talking about music. It was beautiful, you know. Well, I look back now. At the time, you wanted to be somewhere else, probably, or somewhere greater or bigger or whatever, but I'd give probably everything I own to have a half an hour in that room now with those men, you know.
What sort of things did your dad play there?
A lot of old country stuff, blues, but he wrote himself. You know, he was a great writer, my dad, and he never got any... I don't think he ever wanted it, really. He always believed in that music should have a reason to exist, and I still believe in that principle now. That if money's all you want, money is all you'll have. You know, and I know a lot of successful people in the music industry who've made a load of money and are very lonely people, and I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy, you know. So just the pursuit of beauty in song is something like that. I know it sounds a bit pretentious, but it is something that I've always sought at in my life. I'm not really interested in all the other peripheral stuff. It really is very shallow. And for me, personally, I that's the way I view things. And I get more... I'd rather walk the dog than be at the Brits, you know.
What was your first band like then? Or the first band where it wasn't just people sort of messing about, there was kind of like there was some vague plan in place?
That'd be Treebound Story.
What were they like?
Good lads. As people or musically?
Musically,
mean.
Well, both.
We were big Bunnymen fans, you know, Echo and the Bunnymen, and I think we were trying to be like that. And later we found our own sound, but initially we were trying to find a way to be like the Bunnymen. I think it was still a great band who I admire very much. The people in the band, there was Rob Gregory on drums, who's one of my oldest living friends, and he went on to play with Baby Bird later, and he lives in Greece now, in Rhodes. His brother is one of the Pope's envoys, and they were from Brightside in Carbrook. There were six kids in the family, and then there was Cuz on bass, Paul Curry. Cuz, his dad and my dad used to work together in the steelworks, and he lived directly opposite the school gates at Firth Park, and he was a wonderful, still is, wonderful bloke. And there's Paul Infante, who was the singer, who was the kind of the kid I latched onto because he was the weirdo at school. I remember him, he had an overcoat on that was about six zillion sizes too big for him, and he had in marker pen on the back of his coat, he had Dead Kennedys and Public Image Limited, and I just thought, yeah, he's quite an interesting character, you know. And we formed a band, and we're still friends now, you know. And we stuck together for about, I think, between, I can't remember exactly, my memory's awful, but we formed when I was about 15, and we stayed together until I was around about 23. But we were John Peel favourites, and we did a few sessions for John, and we released four EPs, and we recorded an album. They never got released. Actually, the master tapes, they got in a fire, they got burned, but it was probably for the best. No, we wrote some good songs. There were some really nice songs that we wrote, but it was definitely of its time. It was kind of indier than thou.
Playing with your head. You look my way.
At the time, we used to do gigs with Pulp. We used to do joint headliners because we were the only other band in Sheffield that could fill out the Leadman, which at the time was a 1,500 capacity gig. And we used to sell it out, and Pulp would do gigs with us, and then we'd do gigs with them. And that was where I met Jarvis, you know.
I was going to say, when did you first meet him? Because you two seem to have a really nice relationship. What were your first impressions of him when you met him for the first time?
I remember the first time I saw him was actually walking down Fargate with an Hoover in his hand. On a sunny day, and he always had that quite mad professor sort of vibe. I didn't know whether what he was going to do with the Hoover. I kind of thought that's going to turn into a space rocket, that somehow that is going to end up on the surface of the moon because of the power of that man's imagination. I remember Rob Gregory, actually, our drummer, his older brother David, he lived in London, and he'd always come up to Sheffield and say, have you heard this band Felt? Have you heard this band The Smiths? Have you heard this band? And he'd always see all these really amazing bands way before we did, and we'd hear him on John Peel, but he got to see them live, you know. And he came up with an album. So, have you heard this Sheffield band called Pulp? And I said, yeah, I've seen their name written on walls. I've heard of them. And their first album, It, I still think that's actually one of Jarvis's finest records. Would you like to hear about the things I fear about my life? Why should I tell you if I told you a secret? You'd be sure to leak it. You couldn't keep it inside. No matter how hard you try, boats and trains and boats and trains and funny things are.
What about your first taste of mainstream success? I suppose that would be the Long Pigs. Did you enjoy that? Did you enjoy that first kind of taste of the bigger crowds, kind of widespread audiences, buying the records, proper touring?
I thought I did. You buy into this whole Western capitalist kind of thing that, you know, I don't know, it never fitted well with me. I was never quite happy with it, and it didn't seem like I deserved it. The moment it descended on me that it just felt a bit wrong was when we were on tour with U2 in America, and we were playing Giant Stadium in New York. Somebody, for a laugh somewhere, had got like a limo for each of us to take us to the gig, and I just felt so awkward with it. And there was a guy behind us as everybody was waiting to go to the gig who'd got no legs, in a wheelchair, begging for change. and he was like, Vietnam vet, please help. And it just dawned on me, this is wrong. It really, really hit me. And it should hit anybody a lot easier, but, you know, I was young and a bit dumb, probably. And it just didn't fit. The reasons why I wanted to be successful were not anything to do with all that. They were to do with music has to exist for a reason. And I don't really believe in all that stuff. It is success. And the whole culture that we live in now, the culture of humiliation, which I really abhor, X Factor stuff and all that. I know that it's great TV for certain mindsets, and I've got nothing against it in terms of that. But the cultural stranglehold it has on progress, because it's the same always, isn't it? You know, over and over again, the same thing. I don't know. It's hard to analyse, really, but it does slightly do me head in. I think music should have a reason to exist. It's why I love folk and blues music so much, because it's a reflection of... I try my hardest to write music that's a reflection of things around you immediately, rather than let's write a song about what it might be like to be in a swimming pool in LA, you know.
You didn't need me. understand, my Lord. Walk into the river, take my rocking chair, let that feeling overtake me. Drift away from here, my Lord. Think I'm coming home to you, my Lord. Think I'm coming home, my Lord. Got a situation blowing in my head. Short time to stay here, long time to stay dead, my Lord. Going to the station, time for me to go. Don't think that I will miss you. When that whistle blows, my Lord, I think I'm coming home to you, my Lord. I think I'm coming home, my situation. Something just bothers me. Don't know if I can make it somewhere else. Going to the river, take my old chair. Drift away from here, my Lord. Drift away from here, my Lord. Drift away from here, my Lord. Drift away from here, my Lord.
I'm Matt Everett. You're listening to The First Time with Richard Hawley. That was Coming Home, the opener from Richard's debut mini album. I asked him how he first came to record a solo album.
I did that first record, the mini album thing, and it was almost, I sort of did it as a laugh in a way, but half ha ha ha, hoping someone laughed with me. No one did, you know. They all said, that's actually quite good, which was very nice of them to say that. And it was just downtime. There was loads of downtime in the studio. And there was like a week left over. I just said to Colin Elliott, who's my long-time co-producer and string arranger, and he's become that, you know. He became the string arranger because he was the only one that could read music, you know. And he's brilliant at it. He's become really, really accomplished. But they, from little acorns, great oaks grow, as they say. Yeah, we did that mini album, and it was, I wrote 7 songs in about 4 days, and we recorded it all. I played 90% of the music on it. I set everything up in the round in the studio and one microphone in the middle, so if I was playing drums, you'd point it towards the drums. There was no close mic, and it was just all ambient recorded, and that's why it's got that sound. And I mixed it in my head before we got to the desk, so if there's anything that I wanted louder in the mix, I'd move the microphone closer to the amp. And that album and the second one, Late Night Final, had the similar thing, that I mixed it by moving the microphone rather than using faders. So you just pull it all up on the faders and have everything level, and it'd be pretty much there. Because That's how I heard it in my head, you know. And I didn't realise I was onto something. It was just I was writing songs that were influenced by the stuff I grew up with, you know, rather than I want to be a pop star. It had a great effect on me. I just thought, that sounds okay, you know. And it was the first time the first song I sang, which was Coming Home, which is the first single off that record, I was so drunk when I sang that, which is why the vocal is slightly off key. And I was so scared to sing the first time, really terrified. And then Jeff Kraft, who was Pulp's agent, live agent, who was one of my most trusted, lovely friends, a great guy, he put me on tour on my own with an acoustic guitar supporting Frank Black and the Catholics. And I went round England with them, and it was then that I was forced, in a way, to consider the issue of being a lead singer. The actual physical movement from being a guitar player at the back or the front or whatever is maybe 10 feet to the left to be where the lead singer's mic, or depending on obviously the size of the stage you play. But it is actually in your mind, it's 20,000 light years away, you know, the role that you play. And I'm still learning that now. I never quite had the ego for it, I don't think. That, you know, a lot of lead singers that I've worked with over the years doing sessions and playing in bands, they often had like an ego the size of Saturn and all its rings, you know. And I didn't quite have the required planet-sized ego, I suppose. But I like singing, you know. I've always liked singing. I really love to sing. As I love to sing harmonies the most. It's my favourite, with other people, to share the sound of voices. It's an amazing experience, you know.
Thank you.
mention that. I mean, you've worked with some fantastic people over the past few years. I mean, what was it like first stepping up to the mic with Guy Garvey? That must have been a pleasure.
Me and Guy met because, again, going back to Frank Black, Charles, the singer, you know, the Pixies, who's, again, another amazing person, is that Jeff Kraft, I was going back before, got this idea for me and Guy and Charles to do this gig at the Jack Daniel's factory, which we went to Lynchburg, Tennessee. And me and Guy were sat together. I'd never met him before, he never met me. We were aware of each other's music, you know, and I love Elbow, I always have, they're great. They'd booked the tickets so that me and him were kind of sat together. You know, you get them big jumbos where there's four seats on the left wing, four seats on the right, and two in the middle, you know. But we were right in front of where they have the screen. You know what I mean? And there wasn't a lot of leg room or nothing. And it's flying to Tennessee is a hell of a long way to look at the floor if you don't know someone. And I just thought, I'd just be myself. And I just went to WH Smith's and bought Travel Battleships and Connect Four and a big bag of sweets, and, you know, I covered myself in a Michelin Man-sized nicotine patch, you know, and loads of newspapers and magazines and all that. And I got Travel Battleships out, and I don't think I even opened another bag of anything. Me and Guy just played Travel Battleships all the way with all the stupid voices from... Remember those magazines, that those little comics used to be Commando? You know, got an email, die, big dog, and all that. And we were doing stupid voices all the way. And by the time we'd actually landed in America, we'd bonded fairly well as people before we'd even discussed music. We were travelling home, and on the homeward flight, Guy said, would you like to sing with me? And I'd heard him sing in the flesh in front of me, you know, at rehearsals and at the gig itself. And Guy's got an amazing voice. It's very, very startling, especially when he's right next to you, you know, singing. It's beautiful sound. Angelic, really. From such a humorous and wonderful soul that he is.
Oh, The fix is in the snaps of the steward so candid.
The fix is in, yes, our pigeons have finally landed. The Donahue sisters will meet us in France. In penguins and pearls, we'll drink and we'll dance till the end of our days, 'cause it ain't left a chance that we win. 'Cause the fix is in.
When Cole's Corner got nominated for Mercury in 2006, was that, I suppose that was kind of the first big critical success you had, and big success followed with the album afterwards. How did it feel having been doing this work for you and just basically being as true to yourself as you possibly could and recording and writing to make yourself happy for the right reasons, to then all of a sudden have everyone go, now we get it, we love it?
Well, that's the point where you get tested, you see. It tests your mettle and your resolve to not get kind of carried away with it all and realise that, well, the next record might not get this. And because I was a bit older, I think that I took it all with a bit of a pinch of salt a lot. It was great, and it sounds like I've been, you know, whinging and moaning, but it was fantastic to for that to happen to that record. And it meant that, well, I mean, record sales alone went from 20,000-30,000 to, you know, 150, whatever the hell it was, you know, three sales. The media's kind of way of doing things is that they don't really listen to the music at all. Do you know what I mean? They analyse what you wear and what you... All of a sudden, the way you look and the way you wear becomes an issue. That was quite weird for me. All of a sudden, you know, being in men's magazines and that was rare wrong for me.
Hold back the night from us. Cherish the light for us. Don't let the shadows hold back the dawn. City lights glowing, the traffic of life is flowing. Out over the rivers, on into dark. Maybe there's someone waiting for me with a smile and a flower in her hair. Going downtown where there's people, the loneliness hangs in the air. No one there real waiting for me. No smile, no flower, no word.
speak of life is flowing. Out over the rivers and on into dark. Hold back the night from us. Cherish the light for us. Don't let the shadows hold back the dawn. Voices fill the air. Maybe there's someone waiting for me with a smile and a flower in her hair. Going downtown where there's people, my loneliness hangs in the air. No one there real waiting for me. No smile, no flower, no word.
Out of love once again, but I've got you here with me, friend, 'cause you're here in my arms, here in my arms, here in my arms, here in my arms. Last time I looked it was 9. You know that all things then were fine. I've gone and lost it again, but I've got you here with me, friend, 'cause you're here in my arms, here in my arms, here in my arms, here in my arms.
Final question. We've been going through all these firsts. First single, first gig, first band. So we should finish with the last song. What should we play? It could be something of yours, it could be something that you loved in your past or as a child. What's the song we should play at the end of this?
Teardrop by Santo and Johnny.
Why that song?
I love it so much. It's my ringtone on my phone. Our keyboard player is an expert with all this computer stuff, and I'm a complete useless muppet with any of that. And he gets MP3s onto your phone, and it was the first record. Oh, there you go. It was the first record my dad bought me on Parlophone Records, and it's a really amazing piece of music.
Then that's what we'll play. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me on your show.
This is Radio 2 on the BBC Sounds app, on your smart speaker, and on 88 to 91 FM.
With the BBC News at 4 o'clock, this is Jason Kay. Regulators in the United States have authorised the emergency use of an experimental drug as a treatment for coronavirus. A trial showed that remdesivir helped to shorten the recovery time for people who are seriously ill. John McManus reports.
Remdesivir is designed to disable the mechanism by which some viruses make copies of themselves and potentially overwhelm their host's immune system. It was previously used, unsuccessfully, against Ebola, but preliminary results from a US trial released this week showed it did reduce stays in hospital for COVID-19 patients by 31%, though it did not significantly improve survival rates. The drug's maker, Gilead Sciences, says it will donate 1.5 million vials of the drug for free, but it has yet to confirm how much it will charge for subsequent doses.
Clinicians working on a potential treatment for COVID-19 in the UK have said they're ready to begin using it on patients. The trial at Guy's and St Thomas' Hospital in London will treat patients with blood plasma from people who've recovered from the disease. Commuters could be asked to take their own temperature before leaving home, under plans to make public transport safer when the lockdown here is eventually eased. It's understood the idea is among a number of options being considered in Whitehall. The National Trust has warned that it could earn £200 million less this year because of the lockdown, putting some of its projects at risk. The charity says the government should offer the same financial support to nature, wildlife and environmental organisations as it has to other businesses. Charlotte Rose reports.
The National Trust Director General, Hilary McGrady, has urged ministers to use the recovery from the virus to prioritise green growth and carbon reduction. She says the sharp drop in revenue faced by the charity has already led to the pausing of key environmental programmes like cleaning rivers, flood prevention and soil improvement. Ms McGrady says that without government help, it may have to halt its plan to plant 20 million trees to help it reach a carbon net zero target by 2030.
North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un is reported to have appeared in public for the first time in 3 weeks. The country's official news agency has released photographs showing him opening a fertilizer plant near the capital Pyongyang. There had been speculation about his health since he missed a ceremony marking the birthday of North Korea's founder, his grandfather Kim Il-sung, in mid-April. Alistair Coleman from BBC Monitoring says there are still many questions about the images.
Because the media is so tightly controlled, they've only just sent out pictures of this thing which happened on the 1st, it's the 2nd now. We won't see video for another 24 hours, so we won't really be able to tell how fit and well he is until then. So things happen slowly and we do have to be cautious with North Korea.
$14 billion have been wiped off the value of the electric car maker Tesla. Its founder Elon Musk had tweeted the company's share price was too high. BBC News at 3 minutes past four.